Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen, and thank you for waiting. Welcome to the NIH call on changing labor patterns. All lines have been placed on listen-only mode, and the floor will be open for your questions following the presentation. Without further ado, it is my pleasure to turn the floor over to your host, Mr. Bob Bach. Mr. Bach, the floor is yours.
Thank you. Welcome to the National Institutes of Health media briefing on changing labor patterns. Our speakers today will be S. Catherine Lawn of the Division of Epidemiology, Statistics, and Prevention Research at the Eunice Kennedy Shriver National Institute of Child Health and Human Development at NIH, and Ware Branch, MD, of the Intermountain Healthcare and University of Utah, Salt Lake City. So I will now turn it over to S. Catherine Lawn.
Hi, good afternoon. So the definitions for normal and abnormal labor are derived from a population of women in the 1950s. However, since that time, both maternal characteristics and obstetric practices have changed considerably. So our goal was to examine the differences in labor patterns using data from a contemporary study that was sponsored by the Eunice Kennedy Shriver National Institute of Child Health and Human Development called the Consortium on Safe Labor. And this particular study involved almost 140,000 women who presented in labor for delivery, and we compared them to approximately 40,000 women from the Collaborative Perinatal Project, which was another study from the late 1950s, early 1960s. And our major finding is that labor patterns are longer now than approximately 50 years ago. So I think that's sort of the summary. If I open the floor for questions. One more thing. A couple more points. Just mathematically, we did adjust for two known characteristics of our contemporary group to contribute to increased labor duration, both increased maternal BMI and older maternal age. And these only accounted for part of the increase. And so certainly epidural slows down labor, but there also are other obstetric characteristics that could explain why labor is long, but we don't have a complete explanation. We do believe that there's a reasonable chance that some aspect of the delivery room practice is responsible for this increase, and more research is needed to identify these factors. So based on findings by other researchers, women may simply need more time to deliver than they used to. If labor is proceeding slowly, a physician may opt to give the woman more time before speeding up the pace of labor with a medication called oxytocin or before intervening with a cesarean delivery. So again, more research is needed to confirm this hypothesis. I'd actually also like to see if Dr. Branch, if you have anything in additional to add.
No, I think you've covered it very well. And we're probably good to answer questions if the media might be interested.
Thank you, operator. We'll take questions now.
The floor is now open for questions. If you do have a question, please press the number 7 on your telephone keypad. Questions will be taken in the order they are received. If at any point your question has been answered, you may press 7 again to disable your request. The first question comes from Nicholas Bacalar of the New York Times. Nicholas?
Hi. Thanks for speaking to us. You know, what I'm wondering about is the question of Pitocin. You say that there's been a tremendous increase in the use of Pitocin, and yet labor has slowed down. I'm confused about two things. First of all, about the numbers. You say that the use of Pitocin went from 12% to 31% today. But at another point, you refer to it as a 19% increase, which doesn't seem right. It seems like much bigger than a 19% increase.
To answer your first question, you're correct. So I'm looking at Table 1, just as the overall characteristics of the cohorts. And in the CPP, 12% of women received oxytocin versus in the CSL, 31%. Perhaps you might have been looking at the other tables where we broke it down specifically by parity.
Right. Actually, I was looking at the text. But,
okay. But
never mind.
Okay. But you're right. So oxytocin does increase labor, and a lot of women in the modern cohort received oxytocin. So perhaps labor is even longer in modern obstetrics. But nonetheless, you know, we can't, this is how modern labor currently is being practiced, and this labor's longer, even though they're receiving more oxytocin.
I might add to that that one area of current investigation in obstetrics is whether increased maternal weight, increased BMI, may be linked to less functional labor and less responsiveness to oxytocin. Those things are currently the subject of considerable investigation.
But thank you.
The next question comes from Richard Knox of NPR. Richard?
Yeah, thanks very much. I have read the paper, but I think that in your opening remarks you kind of left us up in the air about a lot of important aspects of it. One particular detail I'm trying to get at is just how much longer our labor has been the most recent group versus 50 years ago, and I realize it's different for primiparous versus nulliparous, and you know, and the people with multiple, you know, later births. But I wonder if you could just characterize that, how much longer are we talking about, and then I have some other questions as well.
Sure. So for nulliparous, so first-time mothers, the median time was 2.6 hours longer in the modern cohort compared to the 1960s.
So the total labor time would be what instead of what?
So if you look at the tables, if you look at table two, this is for nulliparous. So if a woman came in we started at 4 centimeters. So the median time was 3.9 hours in the older cohort and 6.5 hours in the safe labor cohort. And then the 95th percentile, so the upper limit, was 18.5 hours in the older cohort compared to 24 hours in the safe labor cohort.
Yeah, thank you. Mm-hmm. So what are you saying about the likely reasons for this big difference over this time period about what the obstetrical practice patterns that may, in your view, help explain it? Are you saying that there's too much induction of labor? Is it too much use of Pitocin? Too much, too liberal use of epidurals? But how do you parse the likely reasons for this big increase?
Well, part of the reason is explained by an increase in epidural use, and that is known to prolong labor by approximately 40 to 90 minutes. Of course, it's very accepted practice to help improve pain control during labor, but it doesn't explain all of the increase. And really, from this paper, we're not able to fully understand what are the reasons that are leading to longer labor times. I just think that, sorry. Mm-hmm.
But you do think, I gather, that a good part of the explanation does lie in what obstetricians are doing these days versus what they used to do.
Well, it's hard to know fully what is causing the increased labor time. I mean, we do mention in the comment section that certainly a large proportion of women that are pregnant these days do undergo an induction of labor, and how that, so if maybe there's something different about the women that undergo induction versus the women that are allowed to go into spontaneous labor. Or same thing, the women that have a pre-labor cesarean section, maybe there's something different about those women, and that's why the women that are left to go into spontaneous labor, it's just longer. But what those differences are and what the reasons are, we just aren't able to know from this study.
It is important to recognize that our retrospective analysis included women that were felt to be in spontaneous labor. But at the same time, the differences in practice patterns today versus some 50 years ago may have, as has just been mentioned, create a cohort of women who are different in their labor patterns because some have been taken out, leaving a different population, perhaps, for spontaneous labor.
Right. We really just need more research to try to figure out what are these reasons that are leading to longer labor patterns today.
I don't want to monopolize, but I wonder if I could have one other follow-up. You do say in the paper that you think these findings are likely to be controversial. Why and among whom?
Well, I'm not sure that they're controversial, but I think, you know, the main thing is that labor is longer, and so clinicians are using definitions of what's abnormal labor that's based on a population 50 years ago, and given the changing maternal and obstetric practice, the maternal characteristics and changing demographics, what we're really saying is that maybe we need to revisit these definitions in a modern labor cohort.
Well, controversial was your word.
May I say something? Then I guess.
Yeah.
So I think one reason that the findings will be viewed with some controversy has to do with the fact that we're comparing two medical cohorts, two labor cohorts, truly 50 years apart, and one always worries about differences in methodology that would be hard to understand or to see, as it were. And so some skeptics are going to say, gee, you know, you really don't know the details of what was going on 50 years ago to compare them fairly to your cohort today. So there's going to be that kind of discussion. And it's legitimate, I think. Some of the controversy that would derive from this kind of publication has to do with the fact that such things as epidural are not seen. Some experts would say epidural shouldn't be challenged. It's a wonderful pain relief mechanism, and that's true. And so the controversy that arises is should practice be readdressed in some facets versus others.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
The next question comes from Julie Snyder of pregnancy.org. Julie?
Hi. I have a handful of questions, too. One of them you sort of covered. It was when you say practice pattern, what specifically you're referring to, as in the previous or the present practice pattern? And
right. So, you know, we didn't have all of the practice patterns that we were able to look at in our study. You know, one potential one that we've already talked about is an epidural,
mm-hmm.
which certainly previously has been shown to prolong labor. That's pretty well known. But what other practice patterns could be contributing to these? I think we just need future research to try to figure it out.
Such things that are hard to discover is, in the late 50s and early 60s, how much did people get up out of bed during labor and walk about, for example? We now know that in modern times, since in excess of 80 or 85% of patients have epidurals, once that's in place, they're in bed.
Mm-hmm. Okay, good. Yeah. That one makes sense for certain. Add a little gravity, it doesn't hurt things a bit.
Well, I don't think we can say that. All I'm saying is there's a difference.
No, you can. I can, though.
Okay, you can say that.
I can't quote you as saying that.
No, you cannot.
So, what effect do you expect these findings to have on current obstetrical practices?
Well, I can tell you that in a previous study that's already been published, we found that especially – you know, a lot of the C-sections that were performed for failure to progress occurred before women got into the active phase of labor. And we used to think that so active phase of labor is when the cervical change starts to accelerate. So on the curve, you can start to see the inflection point. And we used to think, based on the population in the 1950s, that this occurred around 3 to 4 centimeters. And you can clearly see from the curves in this paper that it's not so obvious when first-time mothers become active. This curve is sort of more gradual. And for multiparas, it occurs around 6.5 centimeters instead of 5.5 centimeters. So as long as the health of the mom and baby are okay in labor, clinicians might be able to wait longer for women to get into the active phase before intervening and doing a cesarean delivery. And the same thing as far as oxytocin use, as long as a woman's making change and is progressing at a rate that now we know is normal for modern obstetrics, then they might be able to wait before administering oxytocin as well.
Yes, indeed.
Okay, I have just one more. Is there anything specific that an expectant mom could take home from your findings?
Kate?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's just that. I think for women that are really motivated to have a natural labor and delivery, that they can, you know, feel more comfortable that if their labor is going more slowly, as long as it's within what's been described now in the modern population, that they might be able to wait longer before administering oxytocin or doing a cesarean delivery.
Said in a slightly different way, patients, well-informed patients might want to seek out practitioners who understand the apparent differences in labor patterns then versus now, so that their labor can be managed in modern terms appropriately and favor vaginal delivery when safe.
Great. Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
The next question comes from Kathleen Doheny from WebMD. Kathleen, go ahead.
Hi, good morning. One question's been answered, so I just have two quick ones. Is there an ideal labor range for today, and at what point can a long labor affect the baby, or is that too individual to say?
Ooh, that's a tough one. Yeah. Kate?
Yeah, I mean, I think, so the first question is there an ideal labor range today? I mean, I think this is sort of the first step, is providing the information as far as what labor looks like. One of the things I can say from, you know, looking at labor patterns is for an individual woman, an average labor time is not as helpful because women follow very different labor, an individual woman follows very different labor patterns. So I think what's more helpful are these numbers at the 95th percentile, so that you can know that an individual woman is going beyond what's within a normal range of labor.
Mm-hmm.
So certainly we provide, you know, the numbers and the table for those.
That's in table two, isn't it?
Correct, yes.
Okay. Table. Got it.
Yeah.
So then the second question, therefore, is unanswerable, right? At what point can a long labor affect the baby?
Right. We didn't look at that specifically in this paper.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
I think that's accurate, yes.
The next question comes from Cheryl Wetstein of the Washington Times. Cheryl, go ahead.
Excellent. Hello. Your paper talks about the use of episiotomy and forceps as being not used as much today. I wondered if that's correct, and how would that impact any change in the labor?
Right. That's a really important point. So if you look at Table 1, combining forceps and or vacuum, about 40% of women in the CBP had what we call an operative vaginal delivery versus only 6% in the safe labor. In episiotomy, 68% of women in the CPP versus 18% in the modern cohort. And so the main thing is that it just makes comparing the what we call the second stage, which is when a woman is completely dilated and starts pushing until she delivers the baby, it makes it really hard to compare those times because most women in the 1950s and 60s weren't allowed to push naturally and deliver the baby.
They had to be delivered with the forceps then, huh?
Well, I'm not sure that they had to be delivered. It's just sort of that was the common practice back then.
Okay.
It's very difficult to say, to point to cause and effect there regarding operative vaginal delivery, but I think these sort of findings would suggest that one should take another look at the use of operative vaginal delivery and training for operative vaginal delivery for its appropriate use in achieving vaginal delivery.
Okay, very good.
Again, if you do have a question, please press the number 7 on your telephone keypad. We have another question on the line from Nicholas Bacalar. Nicholas?
Yeah, it's me again. I was wondering, you know, you have certain obstetrical practices, you know, like Pitocin or epidurals or episiotomies, that might affect the length of leg.
Mm-hmm.
And then on the other hand, there are characteristics of these two groups.
Right.
BMI,
larger babies.
Larger babies, that might also affect them. Mm-hmm. Just within the bounds of your own findings here, of your study, how much is due to practice and how much is due to those changing characteristics?
Oh, wow. I don't know how Kate sees this, but I don't think we could quantify. I don't think we can quantify that. We speculate that some is due to change in obstetric practice, and certainly that speculation should drive us to look at labor process management more intensely than we have in recent times.
I mean, I think that we just did the best that we could with the variables and the information that we had. I mean, the variables that we were able to adjust for, maternal age and race and BMI, gestational age when they came in and delivered, whether or not they presented with ruptured membranes, and the birth weight of the baby, when we took those into account, labor was still longer. And so that's what the third column in the table is, the adjusted median difference. That means we've taken all of those characteristics into account, and what's left over, that difference, is still pretty significant.
Well,
and
then the implication of that is that it really is practice that's causing the difference.
Correct. I mean, as best we could tell, sure.
Yeah.
I mean, there may be unmeasured factors that we just don't know. We need future research to try to figure out what's fully contributing to this longer labor.
We have another question on the line from Cheryl Westing. Cheryl, go ahead.
Thank you so much. Yes, I noticed that your data was gathered up to the early 2000s, and of course we've had record high numbers of older women giving birth. You know, it's just breaking the barriers. In the late 30s, they're giving birth, early 40s, and also many times a multiple birth. And I just wondered, what your observation might be as to how will this impact the labor times and the whole climate of obstetrics at this time?
It's actually an important question, and some collaborators in the Consortium on Safe Labor are currently investigating labor times by maternal age. So stay tuned.
Okay.
I think that's the right answer.
Okay. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. We have a question on the line from Richard Knox of NPR. Richard?
Hi again. Thanks. I just want to clarify something that Dr. Branch said a little while ago about episiotomy and training for
operative delivery
for episiotomy.
I don't mean to imply training for episiotomy, but I'm talking about operative delivery. Yes.
Well, maybe I just need to understand what you mean by training for operative vaginal delivery.
Right. Well, I mean, so one of the questions on the table, based on our observation, is whether a change in operative delivery may be a contributor. The rate of operative delivery may be a contributor to, how long time to delivery takes. I can't say for sure that's true, but I do know that the rate of operative vaginal delivery has declined quite dramatically, especially in the last, I would say, decade or so. And so we do far less of that in practice across the country today.
And by operative vaginal delivery, you mean episiotomy?
Forceps or vacuum. No, forceps or vacuum.
Oh, I see. Okay. Well, that's...
Yeah. The episiotomy is a different procedure.
Yes, I understand. That's why I was confused.
Yeah.
So when you say one should, perhaps when these findings suggest that one should take another look at the use of forceps and suction deliveries, what are you really saying? Should we reevaluate and maybe use them more than we do now, or...?
I'm kind of reluctant to take too much of a stance on that, but I believe that in the mix of factors related to achieving successful and safe vaginal birth, the role of operative delivery, which has fallen off precipitously for non-clinical reasons, should be reevaluated.
Non-clinical reasons such as?
fear of fetal injury and consequences thereof.
Yeah. Can I ask both of you to address as simply as you can what your findings in this study in these comparison groups suggest to you about the relationship between obstetrical practice and longer labors and our very high cesarean rates these days?
Kate?
Right. So I think that we do need to, our definitions of abnormal labor, as I said, were developed in a population of women approximately 50 years ago. They're very different from contemporary obstetrical populations. So I think that we've shown that labor is longer, and it may just be it's natural now that labor is longer, and so we may need to reevaluate intervening for a C-section specifically for the reason of what we call labor dystocia, or labor that we think is not progressing normally.
Indeed.
Do you want to elaborate on that, Dr. Branch?
Well, I think she said it well, that in the past, the past definitions of normal labor, quote-unquote, have been used to draw the line in the course of a labor as to when it's time to intervene with a cesarean. That's a fairly sensible process management scheme, I think. But what we've shown is that labor is actually longer, even achieving a vaginal birth, today than it was 50 years ago. And that certainly calls for a reassessment of when one should draw the line for cesarean delivery. And I think that's what Katie said as well.
Mm-hmm. Right, and knowing that our cesarean delivery rate is so high, previously we found it was 30% in the main study from this cohort. If you think about all the women that ended up having a C-section for what was thought to be prolonged labor might even be long, might be even longer in the modern obstetrical cohort.
Right.
So we don't know that because we weren't able to follow those women.
So basically, your data suggests that the yardstick for when to do a cesarean may be outdated.
Correct.
That's mm-hmm. absolutely correct, and I think that's an important point made by this comparison and by other features of the consortium on safe labor study.
Good, thank you.
Mm-hmm. We have a question on the line now from Robin Weiss of About.com. Robin?
Hi, thank you for taking my question. So understanding that the national cesarean rate's over 32%, which I know is the most recent data, so it was a little bit less when you guys did your, when you took your data, and that does include pre-labor cesareans. How does an intrapartum cesarean rate of 12% from your study compare to national averages?
Let's see. Kate, do you know the national average right this minute?
Yeah, I'm not sure off the top of my head what the national average is.
I don't want to misquote that. Yeah.
I mean, I think, the one thing I do know is that what was really surprising to us is that one out of three nulliparas, so one out of three first-time moms, ended up with a C-section in this cohort. So, high.
Mm-hmm. Right. As I sit here, I don't know the national average for nulliparous and multiparous patients in the sort of average facility around the country.
Right.
It may be worth noting that this CSL cohort was gathered from centers around the country representing the entirety of the geography. But those centers were centers interested in, to some degree, by way of their participation in the study. They were interested in labor and labor management. And I wouldn't be surprised if a 12% overall intrapartum cesarean rate was relatively lower than the national average, but I can't be sure because I don't have the figures in front of me.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, the intrapartum cesarean delivery rates are in another one of our papers, the Contemporary Cesarean Delivery Practice in the United States.
Okay.
So it was published in the same journal in AJOG in 2010. So
there you go. Yep.
There's, all the numbers are in that paper.
All right. Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
There are no other questions in the queue at this time. Again, if you do have a question, please press the number 7 on your telephone keypad.
Lovely.
Another question on the line from Richard Knox of NPR. Richard?
I don't want
to... you're doing fine.
Pressure too much. But I'm just... this sounds like a dumb question, but I'd just like to get Dr. Lan to go to the next step in saying why it was really surprising to you to see a one in three cesarean rate among first-time moms.
Yeah.
Well, I think, you know, so we knew that the national cesarean delivery rate was rising, and we thought, and we were correct, that the biggest contributor was due to women who had had a prior cesarean delivery electing not to undergo a trial of labor, or what people call a VBAC. So we knew that that was a large contributor to the rising national cesarean delivery rate. But what we didn't know is at the time is when in labor were women having their cesarean deliveries. And so it was really interesting to us to find out that one out of three first-time mothers, and the reason that's important is because then in their subsequent pregnancies, that will potentially increase the C-section rate further because if they elect to have another repeat cesarean delivery. So really, if we wanted to decrease the national cesarean delivery rate, looking at ways to decrease it in the first pregnancy is really important. And so that's one of the reasons our current paper is really important, because it's we really need to know that labor is longer in modern obstetrics so that we can avoid unnecessary deliveries if it's just for slow labor. If that makes sense.
Yeah, thank you. There's one mention in the paper towards the end about some of the cost implications of longer labors. And I wondered, from the Intermountain data, what could you talk about that a little bit? What do you mean by that?
Well, we, in writing the discussion for this paper, we thought it would be interesting to at least make a sort of general mention of the fact that longer labor is more expensive. And we put that in there because we're very much aware that healthcare costs are on the rise and are a national dilemma. So we thought that that might cause readers of this article to focus just a little bit on their labor management process. If we're really taking a couple of hours longer today than we did 50 years ago, then and it costs us considerably more money, then maybe that would drive us to improve our process, or at least look into the details of why labor is longer, hoping that we might then improve our process.
But I assume that the cost of a cesarean done prematurely is more than the cost of waiting a couple more hours with
that's
care.
That's fair. Yeah, mm-hmm. Indeed.
We have another question on the line from Robin Wise. Robin, go ahead.
Hi, thanks, and I'm sorry to come back, but I have another question, particularly as it relates to the definition of labor as far as mothers believe.
Mm-hmm.
So labor's longer. Could it also be possible that women are coming to the hospital sooner?
Okay.
So we actually looked at, we don't know the time of labor prior to when a woman presents to the hospital, but one of the ways that we sort of tried to address that is looking at the cervical dilation of when they presented in labor. And in fact, if you look at sort of the overall dilation in nulliparas, they were a little bit more dilated on average than the women in the older cohort. So we don't think that that's one of the reasons.
Well, because dilation is not necessarily labor. Women can be dilated well before labor begins. I'm wondering if, you know, and we also know that contractions aren't necessarily labor because many women don't understand that, you know, you can have contractions and if they aren't getting stronger, longer, and closer together, then guess what? They're just contractions. And as annoying as they may be, it's not labor. I know one of the things that we've been seeing locally and that I've seen in some other smaller studies is that, you know, perhaps using different definitions of the beginning of labor for women to stay home might be one of the ways to address that longer labor and then the additional costs of this longer labor.
Well, I think that, you raise a good point. I think, again, one of the ways that we tried to look at this is by comparing the times based on when a woman, you know, would have presented in labor and on the different cervical dilations. So we calculated it from how long it took from them to go from 4 centimeters to complete, from 5 centimeters to fully dilated, from 6 centimeters to fully dilated. And no matter where you start, labor is always longer in the longer cohort. And really for nulliparous women, 6 centimeters is certainly pretty far along, and labor is still longer by, over an hour. So I think that it's not entirely due to what you're suggesting.
Okay, thank you.
Mm-hmm.
There are no other questions in the queue at this time. Again, if you do have a question, please press the number 7 on your telephone keypad.
Okay, this is Bob Bach, and I guess it looks like you've asked your questions. They were all good ones. If you don't have any more, then I think we will end this briefing.
Thank you, guys.
Thanks so much.
This does conclude today's teleconference. You may now disconnect.
All right. Kate, I'm going to go and do